WHFR and Metaphysically Speaking are pleased and excited to announce our fourth annual Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair, Saturday, March 24th from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the Student and Culinary Arts Center on the campus of Henry Ford Community College. There will be a great selection of vendors, readers, and body workers. Local musicians will be performing in our cafe area, and starting at noon, we have some very interesting speakers for you to enjoy. Admission cost to this fantastic event is only $5, and students with current school identification are free. That's the Festival of Enlightenment Holistic Fair, Saturday, March 24th, from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Henry Ford Community College. We'll see you there.
Well, he moved early. That's going to draw the yellow flag.
Offsides, number 72, 5 yards.
Check out this fan leaving the game. He's headed straight up the middle and right into a sobriety checkpoint. Let's see how he handles it.
No, officer. I haven't been drinking. I'm the designated driver.
Upon further review, this fan made the right call by being a designated driver.
Sign up to be the designated driver at the stadium and always buckle up. Provided as a public service by the station and Team Coalition.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
The best in indie and experimental rock. Listen to the Left of the Dial radio program every single Tuesday and morning from 10 a.m. till noon here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. That's the Left of the Dial program every single Tuesday from 10 a.m. till noon on WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Hey, this is Derek, and listening to Skepticality, an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, for Tuesday, March 13th,
Skepticality. Science!
Welcome once again to Skepticality, the show which provides you with news and interviews from leading skeptics, scientists, experts, and people from all walks of life for the promotion of critical thinking and science. It has been a while since someone out there has sent us their own science shout-out. So, if you want to share your love of science with the world, please send us a recording of yourself or anyone or a group which you know can convey the love of science in audio form. You can send those audio bits to our email at hosts@skepticality.com. We look forward to getting more of those on the air. Since it happens to be yet another episode of Skepticality, I must turn once again to my buddy, Tim Farley, so he can let us know all about the skeptic history for this moment in time.
It's time to spend a few minutes in skeptic history for March 2012. I'm Tim Farley of whatstheharm.net and skeptools.com. Each edition, we look into history to remember key events of science and skepticism. This edition, we've got kind of a random walk through some of the history of bad scientific observations. Critiquing pseudoscientific observations and conclusions is a core activity of skepticism. Now, of course, any scientist can simply get a measurement or observation wrong. Catching that is part of the function of replication of results. But skeptics know there are many more subtle ways that observations can go awry, making replication impossible. One way is to use a non-scientific notion as a premise for an experiment. That was one of several things wrong with an experiment famously reported in the New York Times on March 11, 1907. Dr. Duncan McDougall set out to prove the existence of the human soul by carefully measuring the weight of humans and dogs at the moment of death. He found humans lost weight at the moment of death, but dogs did not, and he came up with the figure of 21 grams as the weight of the human soul. His experiments had many, many issues, but among them are the ideas that the soul would have a measurable weight and that dogs don't have souls were preconceived notions based more in McDougall's personal religious beliefs than they were in science. As a result, any measurements he did were kind of bound to be random. And yet, the 21-gram figure has become a bit of a meme, even serving as the title of a major motion picture. Another way scientists go wrong is allowing their subjective observations to be primed by other information. Priming is a psychological phenomenon in which people are more likely to notice something or engage in a behavior right after thinking of a related idea. One of the most famous examples of priming led to the 19th century idea of life on Mars. Born March 15, 1835, Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli made detailed observations of Mars. In those pre-astrophotography days, this consisted of carefully observing through a telescope and drawing pencil sketches of what you saw. This was naturally an error-prone process. Schiaparelli wrote of canali on Mars, literally meaning channels or linear structures. But some English translations used the word canal instead, which added an unintended connotation that they were constructed and not natural. American astronomer Percival Lowell, born March 13, 1855, picked up on this connotation and became enamored of the idea of life on Mars. His drawing showed the same canals and other features that he said proved the existence of life there. But as it turned out, neither the channels or canals or many of the other features actually existed. They were all optical illusions or simply poor observations recorded in the pencil sketches. But once Lowell had been primed to see canals by Schiaparelli's work, he was bound to see them. Another way to foul up an observation is to simply not understand your measuring device. Of course, the many ghost hunting teams spring to mind here, but I'm thinking of an even more peculiar claim that dates from March 19, 1994. That's when Jose Escamilla claimed he first photographed what he calls rods. These supposedly paranormal worm-like flying animals are only visible on photographic recordings. But really, they are just a product of Mr. Escamilla's lack of knowledge of how modern video and digital cameras operate. They aren't paranormal at all. They are simply blurred multiple exposures of entirely normal insects. And finally, of course, a key failure in pseudoscience is often to fail to recognize viable alternative explanations for what you have observed. That's a key element to the Phoenix Lights UFO incident, which happened 15 years ago this week on March 13, 1997. Although this has long been explained as the result of a well-documented military exercise in which several A-10 aircraft dropped flares at night, UFO enthusiasts have repeatedly discounted that explanation for various reasons. The bottom line, of course, is that truly reliable scientific observations are not easy. Skeptics know this, and it is important that we communicate it to the public. There's another 15th anniversary this month, aside from the Phoenix lights. It's a bit more somber. On March 26, 1997, the Heaven's Gate cult committed mass suicide in a home outside San Diego. I've previously mentioned the history of apocalyptic cults on Skepticality number 124. We also have a 30th anniversary that just occurred last Saturday. March 10, 1982, was when the catastrophes predicted by the book The Jupiter Effect were supposed to occur. Of course, nothing happened on that date. I talked about that on Skepticality number 130 and number 150. And so ends this edition of Skeptic History. Links to additional material, as always, will be provided in the show notes. And you can follow me on Twitter or Facebook under the name Krelnik, K-R-E-L-N-I-K, for a new Skeptic History fact every day.
Be a good time for we skeptics and science-loving folks who enjoy reading more about the science behind why we all seem to be such illogical and flawed creatures. What I like is how, even though the topic seems to be the same, each new author or researcher has different ways of explaining and highlighting these flaws, and how we might serve ourselves better knowing how to navigate the buggy software we all have installed in our skulls. When I was sent a movie trailer for the latest book by this week's guest, I had to run out and get it, and then bug him to be on the show and let us know more about himself and what led him to set out to produce such a book, which is so focused on skeptical topics and yet so darn accessible and fun for the general public. David McBrainey is a journalist and fan of science. According to his own website, he attempts to make his findings easy to understand and fun for anyone who is interested. He even explains on his website that if you think something he has stated is wrong in his book, website, or blog, to please let him know so he can make appropriate edits or additions. I think all of us would agree. It would be grand if all journalists thought the same way.
Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy were both assassinated by a man with three names, 15 letters long. John Wilkes Booth and Lee Harvey Oswald. Neither killer would make it to the trial. Both men were shot on a Friday, sitting next to their wives, Lincoln in a Ford Theater, Kennedy in a Lincoln made by Ford. What are the odds? Why do deaths always seem to come in threes? How did the basketball make it in there from all the way across the court? Why did the tornado spare the church? Some things in life seem too amazing to be coincidence, too odd to be random, too similar to be chance. When you desire meaning, when you want things to line up, you see patterns everywhere. Order makes it easier to be a person, to navigate this sloppy world. You're born looking for clusters where chance events have built up like sand into dunes. Picking out clusters of coincidence is a predictable malfunction of a normal human mind, and it's just one of the many ways you are not so smart.
Hello, David.
Hey.
So, I was looking at some of the parts about your book and on your blog, and somebody said that you are a self-described psychology nerd.
Yeah, I I went to college thinking I was going to be a psychologist, but I sort of got, I fell into doing writing for the school newspaper, the college newspaper, and that instant gratification and the love for writing made me just, it was so appealing that I ended up wanting to write more than I wanted to go to my psychology classes. So I ended up moving my psychology to a minor and writing for a living, and that's how I've ended up here today. But I never lost that that love for the epiphany, head spinning sort of thing that happens to you in a good psychology class, where you keep being your beliefs keep getting challenged and your sense of self keeps getting squished lower and lower. So it ended up being the sort of thing that I would talk about at parties or at get-togethers or just with coworkers, and I would say, well, actually, that's called confirmation bias. And that ended up becoming the sort of thing that I tried out a lot of different kinds of blogs over the years, and when I sat down and wanted to write a blog about something very narrow and specific, it ended up being this world of self-delusion, and all my psychology background came back, and it was really helpful, and it's been really fun to explore that sort of stuff.
So what came first? Well, obviously the blog then came first before the book?
Yeah, I started the blog about 3 years ago, and it started out as one of those sort of, I guess I would call it like a junk food kind of thing. I knew I wanted to talk about one specific topic and make that just psychology and self-delusion and and research into that sort of thing. And like the first post on the blog was the infamous Invisible Gorilla video that gets passed around YouTube.
Oh, yeah, we all know about that.
Right. And I was just sort of hopping around to different topics, and it went from the inattentional blindness and change blindness to things like learned helplessness and placebo buttons and pareidolia. And the more I wrote about these topics and the narrower I got, the longer the pieces ended up becoming, and I started really actually pulling in lots and lots of research. I'm lucky because my wife is a librarian, and she's able to get me any study I want whenever I'm doing research, and so I can pull directly from the studies instead of having to depend on web research. And the longer they got, the more of an audience I was able to get, and the more of a mainstream audience I started to get. And I've somehow stumbled into being able to pull these sort of, not only is it stuff that the skeptical movement finds appealing, but I've been able to slip under the radar and go into the mainstream with this blog and talk about these topics that usually don't get as much attention to a mainstream audience. And actually a very strange thing happened the way the blog became super popular was I got into an argument with some friends over which was better, the PlayStation 3 or the Xbox 360. And it's one of those internet arguments that no one's going to win. So, and I sort of came a really knockdown, drag out, long, stupid fight over stupid things that I felt sort of ashamed about. And I wanted to, I asked myself, why would I become so devoted to being right about something like this? And since I already had a blog going about self-delusion, I thought it might be a fun thing to explore brand loyalty and fanboyism. And so I wrote an article about fanboyism and brand loyalty, and that happened to come out about the same time that the iPhone was stolen. And Gizmodo asked if they could republish that blog post, and that ended up bringing in a huge audience. And from that day forward, I've had a large audience of people on the blog, and that translated to getting a book deal.
Very good. So that's how everything came about. It was through somebody stealing an iPhone.
Yes, I'm thankful for someone stealing an iPhone. And it came about because I think, like a lot of good work, when you start to... When you stop commenting on external things and actually go internal and try to expose your own failings and your own tendency to fall prey to bias and fallacy and such, it makes for a lot better writing. I think people were able to connect to that better.
So yeah, I noticed that this book does a really good job of describing most of all the logical fallacies that most skeptics cling to, for mainly for general audience, is this your way to remind us all that we're deluding ourselves minute by minute so we don't feel bad about it?
Well, I think, when you get down to it, I am an example. I am a success story for the skeptics movement when you're going to get down to it. I came from a very religious background. I'm from South Mississippi. I didn't go to a great high school. A lot of my family is pretty intolerant, and I have a dad who is deeply embedded in believing in conspiracy theories, from Ken Hovind to everything else, right? I grew up getting it from both sides, and when you navigate that culture and you start to come out of that shell and develop a critical thinking, an attitude of critical thinking, and you start to, glom on to the outreach of science, like Carl Sagan and C. Clarke, or subversive entities like George Carlin and Bill Hicks, that sort of stuff, the Discovery Channel, Nova specials, all that stuff helped pull me out of that world. And it's informed the way I write, because I try to write these topics in a non-threatening way that will touch people who are in my position as a younger person, or maybe someone who's never seen these topics before. I tried to design the book to be something that a skeptic or an atheist or a science advocate, or hopefully all three, would they could hand over to their mom or dad or cousin or boss and not feel awkward about it, by being fun and funny, and also being more of an introduction and an overview. I hope that it can, it would be like a giant spoonful of sugar, which I think is kind of missing from a lot of the books the skeptic movement champions.
I would imagine if you saw this book in the shelf at a Barnes & Noble, I was about to say Borders, but that RIP on that one. But yeah, so when you see the book itself, it looks like a fun book, really, because of the way it's laid out. I mean, you're not so smart, and it has none of that premise of being this, stuffy, science book. But it is. In a way.
Yeah, I pull a bait and switch in a lot of ways. I'm hoping that the person who walks in is looking for a book like Why Do Men Have Nipples, or like Uncle John's Bathroom Reader or something like that. Yeah. And then they grab this book and they start to read about just world fallacy and hindsight bias and the anchoring effect and things that are well known to people who are either students of psychology or economics or in the skeptics movement, that sort of thing. But to the unbeknownst layperson, this would be a great way to slip this in a way that is non-threatening, because I never really mention religion or political ideology, or I never attack religion or political ideology in the book. But by going to the premises that underlie the sort of thinking that ends up in those worlds, I think it's because I get email and I get letters and I get responses from people who and I know I have family members and friends who are very religious or are very, very have deeply conservative views on certain things, and they totally get the message of the book and don't realize that it may be undermining some of their convictions.
Yeah, I was wondering, because that's kind of the thing I got to take away from this, was it never really focuses on one specific type of person, pretty much ever, other than a couple of spots where it's not really focusing on a person. It's more focusing on, I guess we'd say, bad behavior or things that just don't seem logical once you learn about them, like the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's like, there's a reason now why I know why American Idol, and they keep making more shows like that. And that's one that a lot of people don't really think about. Even the skeptics movement, we don't talk about it very much, but it's a big thing. It's like, well, why do people keep going back for that over and over again?
Yeah, I listen to, I'm a recent, the skeptics movement has done a great job of outreach. I know, because I'm one of those people who I was enjoying science, and the science had done a lot for me of getting breaking me out of those old paradigms of thinking. But it wasn't until I found some skeptical podcasts and started getting the books that were recommended there that I realized there was this whole other world of people who just come right out and say, no, these things aren't real. There's a word for that. There's a term for that. This has been researched before. But it is something that I still notice coming up in the skeptical movement. There are a lot of things that we all still fall prey to, because you really can't excise these things from your mind. You can't not experience confirmation bias. You can't not fall prey to the Dunning-Kruger effect. So that's what makes this so fun to write about, because there's nothing I've written about so far that I can't say, yep, I'm doing that every day, and it's a constant struggle. Especially with Dunning-Kruger, because I try to use a video game analogy in that as well, because it's sort of the difference between going from level 0 to level 10, like in an RPG or something, is so fast that you assume that going from level 10 to level 20 would be just as fast, and level 20 to level 30 would be just as fast. But it's, learning, becoming experienced in something, and whether it be playing the guitar or becoming educated in a certain topic, it's more of a logarithmic process where it's the more you learn, the harder it becomes to reach expert level. And that's just not something we sort of intuitively feel. Like, it's when you pick up the guitar and you first start playing it, you think, man, this is really difficult. I don't know how anyone does this. And you learn a couple chords and you learn a couple songs and you think, oh, okay, well, this actually is really easy. Just another month or two and I'll be as good as anybody out there. And that's sort of the underpinnings of the Dunning-Kruger effect, is you don't realize how far you have to go to become an expert.
And that's how you end up with people, you know, on American Idol thinking they can actually sing, you know, Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, you know, you grow up in move around in an environment where you might be the best singer, you might be the best whatever, and you don't realize how far you have to go to actually compete with people who are better than you, because you haven't been exposed to it. And I know from personal experience, I know I have friends like this who think that they know everything there is to know about, evolution, or you get into an argument with someone on Facebook about climate change or whatever, and they assume that they know as much as someone who's been studying this their entire life. And it's a weird phenomenon.
Yeah. And then talking about Facebook, you even have a whole book, a part of the book, which kind of relates to Facebook, about Dunbar's number. In a way.
When I was writing that was one of those things that came from the blog. Since writing that, Dunbar has put out his own book, which is really cool. And what I write about in Dunbar's number is the tendency for some people in social media to try to gobble up as many friends as they can. And then basically they display that as a form of social jewelry. But like a lot of the topics I write about, it's a way to get into the topic of Dunbar's number, which is that Dunbar says that because of social grooming takes mental effort, you can only really keep up with about 150 people. And that's not really how many, most people do not even keep up with 150 people, much fewer than that. The reason is to actually care about a person, keep secrets with them, pay attention to reciprocal altruism with another person, to know their history and have them know your history, and depend on them to maybe give you a ride or help you move, that sort of thing. You have to engage in social grooming, just like any other primate would. If you were an ape, you would be picking insects and stuff off the other person's back, but we go to each other's Super Bowl parties or just talk on the phone or that sort of thing. And that sort of social grooming takes up a lot of mental effort and takes up a lot of time. And so naturally there is a plateau to how much effort and time you can put into it. And it comes out to be around 150 people.
Also, I noticed that there was one of these fallacies or parts of the book that I think, because you mentioned skeptics, I think we all tend to fall into the third person effect quite a bit. And I read that section. I was like, you know, I think we all, I see this like almost every day, at least three or four times or more, about how people we disagree with must be the stupid ones or the gullible ones.
Yeah. The third person effect, and it goes well, but there's a couple of things on the blog that I've written since the book that sort of explore this even further. The illusion of asymmetric insight and the backfire effect both play into this. And the third person effect, the easiest way to describe it is saying, is sitting in, let's say you're sitting in a in McDonald's, and you're like, and you see people around you eating, and you say to the person with you, I can't believe people eat at McDonald's. It's so disgusting. And you know, you're in there eating the McDonald's. People tend to see themselves as not the sort of person that advertising is geared toward, not the sort of person who lives in their town, not the sort of person who lives in their country, even though they are that sort of person by just being there. They're just a contingent of that. And that especially plays into, say, advertising, where you say, you know, advertising doesn't work on me. You see all these commercials and you're like, oh God, this is so stupid. Why do people fall for this? I can't believe people fall for this. And then, you know, you ask yourself, when you're faced with the choice between one version of a product and another, what's motivating you to pick that thing? Probably the advertising. In the book, I talk about maybe you see an ad for a soft drink or a fast food item over and over again, and every time you see it, you're like, God, this is so stupid. Why did they do this? Who would fall for this? But then one night, when you leave coming home from the bar and you're ravenous, and you think, oh, what am I going to get? That's when that advertising will sway you. So people tend to believe that their opinions and decisions are based on facts, and that other people's opinions are based off of lies and propaganda, and that you're impervious to lies and propaganda. But really, you just we each have different vulnerabilities from each other.
Yeah, because you even mentioned in there that most of us are, even if we think we are, we're not nonconformists. We pretty much all are conformists in a way.
Yeah, you conform to what agrees with your sense of self, what matches your concept of the character that you inhabit, what promotes your self-esteem. So that all plays into self-perception theory, which is what I'm writing about now. My current writing is all about self-perception theory. And that is, you know, the idea is that you have, do you promote social issues because you're a Democrat, or are you a Democrat because you promote social issues? And the research is leaning more toward that the groups that you inhabit have more effect on you than you have on the group. And the narrative that you spin is more a example of attitude follows behavior, not the other way around.
I find it interesting that we all kind of believe the opposite, or we not only don't believe it, we tout the opposite. We're proud of the opposite, even though we're part of it.
Well, I mean, no one wants to see themselves as a conformist. I mean, everyone wants to feel like they're an individual, at least within the culture I'm in. And it's self-esteem building to see yourself as a glorious and intelligent, thoughtful individual. And if there's someone out there who wants to play on those desires and is able to satisfy those desires with a product or a group or a message, then people like ourselves will be more likely to gravitate toward that sort of thing. And I know that it's the more, you know, the character that a lot of us create is the someone who is intelligent and is a critical thinker. And because of that, there are actually products out there. There are actually movements out there. There are actually websites and other things that are geared toward people who see themselves that way. And so they know that whether or not it's by design or just sort of that's how the chips fall, that's going to be the sort of thing that a lot of us gravitate toward.
kind of explains how Facebook got so big, I guess.
The great thing about Facebook, well, when it comes to social media, a lot of social media is self-presentation, and it's like everyone is in their own reality show. Someone said that recently. I don't remember who it was. We all get to be stars in our own reality show, and that's what social media helps do for us. But I think that it makes sense. When I saw Timeline roll out recently on Facebook, it connected with me the idea that we are self-perception theory again, which is the idea that we tend to observe our own behavior and then after the fact make up a story to explain it. And that sometimes that story is close to the truth, and sometimes it's just something that makes us feel better about who we are and what we've done. If we look at what we've done and it brings up anxiety, it hurts our self-esteem or makes us think that we might be ostracized from our group, then we'll have cognitive dissonance, and that goes down one path where you try to rationalize and go through some mental gymnastics to reduce that cognitive dissonance. But if it doesn't raise your anxiety, it goes down this other path where it just becomes create an explanatory narrative that you believe, and it becomes part of your personal narrative. It becomes part of yourself. And Timeline on Facebook is a great example of giving someone a modern tool to engage in a behavior that we're doing all the time. You can actually write your own history. You can create a narrative that says, this is who I am, this is what happened to me in the past. And we tend to do that from moment to moment.
I wonder if when they put that into Facebook, I wonder if they thought about it that way.
I don't think so. You know, it's like, I think a lot of, it's like confidence men, magicians, advertising, all these things are sort of have their own natural selection where what works moves on to the next iteration, what doesn't work gets thrown away. And at this point, after, 100 years or more of engaging in those professions, or in the 5 or 10 years we've got into social media, we're stuck with a lot of things that have worked. And I think what usually works are what things that play into our tendencies to fall into bias and fallacy, and create personal narratives for ourselves. So the longer something has time to play in a environment of selection, the closer and closer it will become to matching and fitting in with our ways of thinking or ways of perceiving.
So before I let you go, what is your favorite fallacy or thing that you've seen others do all the time that really you latch onto and think, I just love that, even though it's terrible?
Confirmation bias is always going to be number one. And I'm really thankful that this recent surge in pop psychology books has put that out there into the public consciousness. But my favorite thing is something I wrote about after the book. It's on the blog. It's called The Backfire Effect, because I'd never heard of it, and it's fairly recent. But that is when, if you engage in an argument with someone over something that they find that's really close to their personal beliefs, and you bring them evidence that shows what they think is incorrect, instead of the person moving closer to the truth, they will move farther away from it. By presenting evidence to the contrary, you will actually cause some people to dig in their heels and believe even more in the thing that's incorrect. That is a crazy, crazy thing that people do, and dependably do in research.
Must explain why climate change denial is so big.
Yeah, every argument that I think a skeptic would find themselves in, especially in a comment under a story or in a forum or in social media, you're going to see the backfire effect just fly out of everywhere, because people, when their deepest convictions are attacked, their instinct is to dig in and double down on their beliefs instead of going, yes, actually, that's a very good point there. I thank you for edifying me, sir. That's much less likely to happen. And you have to, if you know that's going to happen, it's very helpful, because you can avoid that sort of arguing, because it's not going to get you to the result you're looking for.
So what would you suggest then?
Well, humor is always the best way to go about it. And what I find is really helpful is to actually take on the other person's viewpoint and demonstrate its absurdity. I guess sort of the Stephen Colbert approach, where if you actually play out the incorrect viewpoint to its logical conclusion, it is on its face absurd. And that is helpful. And the other thing is to remember, just to stay sane, remember that a lot of these things take a long time to change in the public consciousness. One conversation is not going to change a person's mind. One article is not going to change a person's mind. Because when you present evidence from the internet, the first thing that someone does who doesn't want to believe that is they're going to go to the internet and find evidence to the contrary so they can soothe over that disgusting feeling. They just got a feeling like they are incorrect and that their worldview is off kilter. So just remember that it takes a while. And hopefully this new movement that's around, I hope the skeptic movement is aware. I'm not sure if it is aware of this, the two systems movement that's taking place. It started with Daniel Kahneman in 2002 when he got the Nobel Prize. And since then you've had like Blink, Black Swan, Mistakes Were Made, Drive, Particularly Irrational,
yeah.
How to Decide, all these books. And then culminating, I think this like last year, we had finally Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, Invisible Gorilla, my book, all that stuff came out all at the same time. You can see there's more of them as we go forward. That movement is all about pulling away from the idea that we're all, that human beings are deeply rational, supermen, you know, of reason, and returning to the concept that we have two systems of thought, one that's sort of automatic and prone to bias and everything, and one that's that takes over that system and makes long-term choices and is rational in every way, but it doesn't come to the forefront as much as we think it does. So I think that movement is really going to help change public sentiment, and you're going to see more and more books like this, and it's going to become sort of common sense. Once that becomes common sense that we think in these ways, it'll be easier to have those discussions and convince people of, science says this, and that probably is a better way of looking at it than what your brother-in-law says.
Maybe it should require like all the politicians to actually have like, you know, all these books in their library.
I am continually amazed that politics and science rarely hang out with each other, and the policies are not created with any of this stuff in mind. It blows my mind. I mean, we've known forever that eyewitness testimony is not reliable. Science has we have lots of research that shows that eyewitness testimony is a horrible thing to depend on, yet there it is, still in the legal system. So we have a long ways to go, but I think that we are moving forward faster and with longer strides than ever before.
I blame the fact that we all as humans believe our eyes so much that we just can't imagine being any other way. It's, well, they saw that. It must be true.
Yeah, that's why I hope that I'm just one little pebble in this avalanche of re-examining the human condition and applying more humility to it, applying a better sense of our shortcomings. And when you expect human beings to be a certain way from the get-go, you won't create policies that assume people will save for retirement, or they will abstain from sex, or they will do any manner of things that we assume they will based off of this better angel vision we have of human beings. That's not to say we shouldn't aspire to be this ideal person, but I think when you create political policies and personal policies that that accept our shortcomings from the first notion that they're better policies and they're better strategies for being a person.
Yes. I agree, and this is one of the things I remind people all the time, is that, you know, politics and religion and science, they're all smushed together, if you like it or not. So you have to make it so that the most logical outcome actually happens. And I think that all of our mental fallacies make it so difficult, and it doesn't really, I mean, what do we do to solve that problem?
And it would be good for the skeptical movement to look inward and see, okay, is everyone here in this movement, is everyone here have, is no one in this movement, is everyone in this movement out of debt? Is everyone in this movement have glistening, perfect, muscular bodies? Is everyone in this movement this, that, and the other? And see that all of us are fighting against these natural states of mind, these built-in stumbling blocks, and that by not being above them and by sort of embracing that part of our humanity, it's really helpful to push them forward a message of saying, okay, we know that people tend to see faces whenever there are no faces. So, and because we have a little bit of our brain that is designed, or that is not designed, a little bit of our brain that is evolved to see the human face and recognize it whenever we can. That's why we see things in clouds, and that light socket looks like a face. Therefore, probably that shimmering image in the window is not the Virgin Mary. Sorry. It's a lot easier to push that message out there if people already accept that we're prone to doing certain ridiculous things, and that our minds were, you know, spent a long time evolving in a completely different environment than they're in now. And because of that, we are prone to certain ways of seeing the world.
Exactly. So where can people find your blog, your website, or Shun the Thought on you, and like, they can find you on Facebook?
Well, I keep my Facebook private, but I do have a youarenotsosmart.com is the blog. I have a You Are Not So Smart Facebook page, You Are Not So Smart Twitter account. I have a personal Twitter account that's just David McCraney. I'm also on Google Plus as David McCraney. But you can find all that stuff at the website, youarenotsosmart.com.
Are you going to be at any conferences or doing book signings or anything like that?
I'm the tail end of the promotional part of this this book. I'm actually working on a second book right now. And we're and all sorts of other things related to maybe You're Not So Smart actually might become a television show in the future. And I'm enjoying the idea that I'm able to, that somehow I have I've been able to pull this message out into the mainstream in sort of a sugar-coated way. I'm going to be at the Being Human conference in San Francisco in March, and I'm going to be speaking at Ohio State University later on in the year, but nothing in the immediate future.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me.
No problem. David's personal website and the website for his book, YouAreNotSoSmart.com, has tons of great skeptical information and links to extra information on fallacies, biases, and his own blog entries about all the skeptical things he is interested in. We here at Skepticality have to send out a big thank you to the few people who took the time and money to help support the show in the past couple weeks. It really does make a difference. Keep in mind that you can find the links to everything we talked about in this episode in the show notes on our website, skepticality.com.
Join our discussion forums at www.skepticality.com. Leave feedback by email at feedback@skepticality.com or by phone at area code 206-888-HOAX. That's 206-888-4629. This has been Skepticality. Thanks for listening.
Coming up on Science News Weekly, we're talking about reflecting on the moon, giant fossils, and a few more eggs. That's up next on Science News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Science News Weekly with Dr. Kiki, episode number 3, recorded on Thursday, March 1st, 2012. Signs of Life. It's March 1st, 2012, and this is the science that made headlines this week. Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory have confirmed that there is life on Earth by observing reflected light from the moon. The technique is a modification to Earthshine observation. It's called spectropolarimetry. It involves looking at both color and polarization of light from the Earth after being reflected by the moon. The team was able to confirm that the Earth has a cloudy atmosphere and is covered in part by oceans and vegetation. They foresee it being used moving forward to investigate exoplanets for signs of life. The World Wildlife Fund reported that several U.S. supermarkets carry toilet paper and tissue products, which are directly linked to rainforest deforestation in Indonesia. The products are sold under the brand names Paseo and Livy and are owned by Asia Pulp and Paper, or APP. It is estimated that since 1984, APP and its affiliates have pulped close to 5 million acres of tropical forest on the island of Sumatra. Stem cells were isolated from human ovaries and used to create egg cells in the lab. Following on the heels of work showing that viable egg cells could be produced from the stem cells of adult mice, the study used donated human reproductive stem cells to make human egg cells that appear viable. However, since fertilization of human reproductive cells is against the law in the United States, viability is as yet unknown. The groundbreaking study by researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital promises to revolutionize infertility treatments of the future. For the first time since its discovery in 1977, paleontologists have completely reconstructed the skeleton of a 25-million-year-old penguin from the genus Kairuku. The study is published in the Journal of Vertebrate Paleontology and described a giant yet slender penguin 4 feet 2 inches tall with long flippers and a long, narrow beak. These ancient birds once lived on the island of New Zealand. Giant fleas were found among fossils in China and Mongolia, dating back to the mid-Jurassic and Cretaceous periods. 9 species in total, the fossilized insects share many traits with modern fleas, but had unique traits, including long claws that might have been used to hang on to fur or feathers, and sturdy mouthparts for stabbing and siphoning. Yummy. Genetic sequencing of the remains of the Iceman named Otzi is allowing scientists to tell a fuller story about the mysterious man. The details published in Nature Communications suggest that Otzi had brown eyes, type O blood, was likely lactose intolerant as an adult, had cardiac disease risk factors, as well as traces of Lyme disease, so he was pretty sick, and he can be traced to the people of Sardinia in the Mediterranean. Research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences finds that an asexual species of flatworm overcomes aging by increasing the activity of an enzyme named telomerase. Strangely, similar flatworms that reproduce sexually also appear to reproduce indefinitely, but don't seem to have the same telomerase mechanism in place, making the researchers wonder if the sexual worms use an as yet unknown mechanism to fight aging. In an updated analysis of the T-Rex skull, biomechanics researchers conclude that the T-Rex still holds the record for the most powerful bite. After laser scanning a T-Rex skull from the Manchester Museum, the scientists created a 3D model onto which they mapped muscles. By simulating a bite in the model, they were able to estimate the force used or produced when the jaws shut. The maximum forces measured were between 30,000 to 60,000 newtons. It's pretty forceful. The American Society of Microbiology writes that a team from the Translational Genomics Research Institute have traced the history of MRSA strain ST398. Using whole genome sequencing, they found MRSA ST398 started in humans, jumped to pigs, where it gained methicillin resistance, and then jumped back to humans. This is conclusive evidence that farm use of antibiotics does affect drug resistance in bacteria that can affect human health. Australian scientists created the world's first atomic transistor from a single atom of phosphorus positioned on a silicon crystal. The development is being hailed as an important step in the development of the quantum computer. Again, now, IBM reports to the American Physical Society that it has broken three records in their attempts to create qubits with integrity, bringing quantum computers just a little closer to reality. In several papers, IBM researchers describe a three-dimensional superconducting qubit setup approaching the minimum standards required for quantum computing. And scientists at IBM Research Zurich imaged the charge distribution of a single molecule for the first time using a technique called Kelvin probe microscopy. The team measured the charge on the molecule naphthalocyanine in such a way as to determine the positions of electrons within the molecule. And that does it for the Science News headlines this week. Let me know what you think about these news stories, or tell me what you think should be news by emailing Dr. Kiki at drkiki.tv, or leave me a voicemail, 650-741-KIKI. To watch the full episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour, head over to twit.tv/Kiki. Thanks for watching.
Earth, sky.
What we do is to explore things that are interesting. So a basic program is to find something that's interesting to us from the point of view of curiosity, understand how it works, see what it's good for, and then in some cases when we're lucky, we might be able to spin out at the end something that would be a small business, a startup that would start transferring the benefits of knowledge into a society in terms of solutions to problems.
You're listening to chemist George Whitesides of Harvard, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. Whitesides is the most influential chemist alive today, with more scientific citations in published work than anyone. He's co-founded a dozen companies worth over $20 billion. And behind his work, he says, is a desire to create simple solutions for difficult common problems, such as low-cost health diagnostics for developing countries like Rwanda. George Whitesides talked more about what it means to be a chemist today with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. Whitesides, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
I'm very happy to be here.
What inspired you to study chemistry, and what was the science community like as a young scientist in the 50s and 60s?
Chemistry is a really terrifically interesting area because it's about the world that we can see and feel. So if you're curious, you want to know why leaves are green and why things are alive and why the paint on walls is white or red, and that's what chemistry does. So the original motivation was just that it was great fun to think about how the world worked. And in the 50s and 60s, when I started in that glacial time, chemistry had a pretty restricted view of what it did. That is, it made molecules, which are very small collections of atoms. And molecules are what makes up air and drugs and the molecules that go into polymers and paint and gasoline and all of that kind of thing. But really, the purpose of chemistry was to make molecules. It's gotten to be a lot more expansive. It's now very interested very broadly in the question of what is life, and very interested very broadly in the question of what are materials, and then other things as well. But it's a wonderful area because it brings you into contact with almost anything that you see and feel and taste and smell and talk to.
Would you tell us a little bit about some research that you're doing on something that you've described as soft robots? What's going on there?
Robots are really, really interesting as a subject and as a kind of technology. The core problem with robotics is that there are circumstances in which doing a job can be too dangerous for a person. It could be impractical for a person to be in that circumstance. The problem that needs to be done can be too complicated. An example is using robots to lift heavy panels in place and welding the body parts of an automobile. So most of the robots that you see have been developed either as part of manufacturing or sometimes for applications, let's say, in the military, where you would like to not have people defusing a explosive device. You would like to have a machine doing the defusing. Now, most of these robots are either made to look a little bit like animals or people. That is to say, they are so-called hard robots. They have a skeleton and they have motors that run things that might be arms and legs. Or sometimes they have treads, but the treads are fused then to something that looks like an arm. But if you think about the world around you, it's full of creatures that are butterflies and worms and octopi and starfish. And these are all creatures that don't have a hard internal skeleton. They have some different structure that holds them together. So we're very interested in putting together robots that are soft and look less like a dog and more like a starfish. And, of course, the connection to chemistry in that is that these creatures are not made out of these machines, are not made out of metal and springs. They're basically made out of rubber and elastomers and things like that, as is the original creature. So the trick here is to find ways of putting together the material science of elastomers in such a fashion that when properly actuated, you can get behaviors crawling and jumping and moving through holes that begin to look like these soft things that we live with in the world. And we believe there'll be a whole range of applications in these from to take to solve problems. And we have the problems that need to be solved because they're everywhere. And why is it we don't have jobs? And that's a very complicated question, and the answers are very complicated. But basically, a short-form answer is that the United States right now tends to emphasize the solution of problems that can be solved very quickly. And the solution to complicated scientific problems often takes a rather long period of time. So in my view, and many people's view, one of the things we want to think about is how do we encourage more innovation and the creation of more new jobs in the United States. So we've been working, we and many other people in the United States are working on trying